Welcome to the Rennie Podcast, where we talk about the real estate market and the people connected by it. Our goal is to empower you to make informed decisions and provide context for the real estate world around you. We hope that with every episode, you will become a little more knowledgeable and a lot more curious.
Welcome to the Rennie Podcast. I am Ryan Berlin, head economist in our intelligence division. Across from me is the venerable Mr. Ryan Wise, market intelligence manager, lead analyst within Intel. And today is special because we are joined by none other than, drumroll, Brendan Ogbenson, dad, fun guy, and also chief economist at the BC Real Estate Association.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Welcome, thank you for coming. I just want to introduce the episode, and then Brendan, we want to turn things over to you for a little bit. So we want to talk about a few things today, as you do on a podcast, and I'm sure that we'll meander, we'll get off topic, but we'll try to stick to some sort of script here. As far as subject matter is concerned, we'll touch on the trade war that we're currently engaged in with the U.S. I think some adjectives that you've used to describe it include dumb.
What ones you can say on this podcast? Yeah.
Keep it PG.
I was gonna say, oh, that's right. Yeah, like we prefer. Yeah, if we don't swear, then we don't get the explicit label.
I'll do my best.
Your darndest.
My darndest.
We'll also talk about how BC's housing markets have been faring more recently, and then also what the upcoming federal election might mean for us here in BC, for our economy and our housing market. So. Anyway, Brendan, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
You're coming in hot from Chilliwack. What were you doing in Chilliwack?
I was doing what I've been doing far too often, which is talking about tariffs to an audience of realtors or other people in the industry. So I've almost got it down. I think I've almost got it memorized. I've got like 50 speaking engagements on the books between like January and June, which is usually what I do in a year.
That is wild.
I'm just talking about tariffs. Here I am to talk about tariffs, which no, we've been nonstop like since November, basically after the election, just running model simulations. I'm, you know, mainly a macroeconomist. And so we're just like, what are the effects going to be? And like measuring those against other benchmarks from other economists. And then they're constantly being updated. And then the tariffs change every day. So you guys probably have the same problem these days. Is just you're just constantly updating a slide deck and updating talking points.
Absolutely.
And answering questions. Didn't, like, what does this mean now?
Yeah. Didn't you do a whole series on the original threatened 10% tariffs that like didn't even make it to January?
I did. We put out a whole market intelligence report called Choose Your Own Misadventure, and it was comparing 10% tariffs, which like seems very quaint. That's adorable, 10%. And then 25%, which I originally, you know, if you follow me on LinkedIn, I've just put all these, like, I've just kind of go through all the iterations of what we've been doing. And like, I remember not even doing the 25. I was like, that's ridiculous. 25% tariff. And because I ran it, I was like, that's pretty ugly. And like, I didn't even bother with it for a while. Mm-hmm. And then that suddenly became the norm.
Ridiculous became the norm.
I think that's a good, that's a good slogan for 2025, right? Chaos is the norm. Or my favorite, everything's computer, which
I want that on a t-shirt. I mean, like, that is amazing.
There's a certain genius in everything's
everything
computer.
Everything is computer. I mean, I think he was like, genuinely gobsmacked. Like this is what cars look like. Like some cars look like this.
Said that's why he told him it was like a golf cart, because that's something that he understands.
We got a little sense for what you do, being a macroeconomist. But if you could take a couple of minutes and maybe tell the listeners about BCREA, its mandate, and really, what you. Tariffs aside, I mean, right now tariffs are very relevant, but like what do you do with BCREA?
So I've been with BCREA since 2010. I replaced Brian Yu, who then moved on to Central One.
Small world.
Part of our little economics community in Vancouver. I started joining in 2010 from PricewaterhouseCoopers, where I was working in economic consulting. BCREA is just like a member organization, so we have kind of an odd structure for an industry association, and that individual, like realtors, aren't part of the industry association, but they're part of a member board. Mm-hmm. And those member boards are the members of BCRA. So we represent 27,000 realtors or so, but through the, I think it's eight, because there's been some mergers, eight member boards mm-hmm. around the province. We do advocacy, which I don't do because I'm not a lobbyist. We try and keep that totally independent from economics. And then we do education and standard forms and stuff I don't know very much about. My group is the economics team. There's two of us, and we just try and we put out, you know, monthly stats, and then do, you know, all like media and presentations. And then my favorite part is like we try to reserve like at least a third of our resources essentially for like think tank kind of work, where we try and put out like original research. So earlier, I guess it was last year, I guess we put out some research on like what it would take to actually hit housing targets in terms of like productivity and how big would the labor force in construction have to be, and that kind of answering those types of questions. And then, you know, this year we put out a kind of a broader analysis of tariffs. So we try and do like original macro kind of mm-hmm. research that you would see at like a think tank or anything that's like really, you know, related to housing that might help realtors out, answer some questions from clients, or even to like, you know, advise our GR people what they should be saying to the government. Yeah. Or
yeah. And I'm sure many listeners are going to be familiar with your work. You are I mean this in the very best way. You're very prolific on LinkedIn. I'm working on it. I look up to you. But yeah, you put out a ton of great research, and mm-hmm. just made a note here that you devote a third of your time to original research. Like
try. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's the way you need to do it, because if you don't set that time aside, you live on the surface, right? And you're in reaction mode all the time. It's
when you're doing as much speaking as I do, man, it gets boring unless you have new stuff to say.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you kind of have to like find some new stuff to say every once in a while. Sometimes it does not hit. Like, I mean, I got this one section of my presentation right now talking about like the Bank of Canada's neutral rate and like how they calculate it and stuff. I can tell people are not interested. You know who is? Me. And I'm going to keep talking about it.
Well, it's funny. You have to be excited about your content.
100%.
You do. 100%. And there is very much a similarity between, you know, we all give these presentations to audiences, and they are like being a presenter of this type of material, especially when you do as much as you do, is very much akin to being a stand-up comic. I mean, in two ways. One, I know I think we all tell jokes you want to amuse the audience, but you're trying to amuse yourself as well.
Every time,
And the other thing is you're testing material all the time, right? Like, did that land? Do I need to change the way that I sort of frame that?
It's so funny too, the stuff that doesn't hit that I think is going to be awesome. So like every time the stupid thing, whenever the Bank of Canada lowers rates, and I find some dumb gif of like something to do with cutting, and then I usually like
used a chainsaw the other day, which I don't think you can use chainsaws anymore.
No, yeah, and then I'll put Tiff Macklem's face, like I put Tiff Macklem's face on Leatherface, and it's like, it's a cut. And I've done it with like Rocky, like the Russians cut, or like whatever, like any dumb thing. And I thought it made me emboldened because you liked it on LinkedIn and said this was good. It's like, all right, this is gonna hit. And then I used it in a presentation. I felt like I just got like blank stares. And before that, I was using Tiff Macklem's face on Bill the Butcher from Gangs of New York, which is like not a timely reference. And like, there might be like 10% of the audience even knows what I'm talking about. But I'm like, I know what I'm talking about.
That was a big movie 20 years ago.
25 years ago. Yeah. So
I'm very okay with putting content, these little Easter eggs in your presentations that amuse only you.
Oh yeah.
As the presenter.
My problem is I think I'm getting to the point where they're only to amuse me. And like if the audience likes it, that's fine.
Okay. Let's pivot into some meatier stuff here. Let's start with some opening remarks on tariffs. We don't like what's happening with tariffs generally. I'll sort of keep it open-ended to start, and we can have a conversation around this, but Brendan, you're sort of your thoughts on the situation, and you can start wherever you want.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know if you, how much you guys have talked about tariffs in this podcast before. The place I always start in presentations is like, what is a tariff? Because not everyone knows what tariffs are, how they work, including the president of the United States, who, you know, even their press secretary for the president called them a tax cut for the American people.
Yeah.
I don't know where they get some of this stuff. Anyway, it's just a tax on imports, right? So it's a tax on imports paid for by U.S. households and U.S. consumer or U.S. and U.S. businesses. If you have like the super integrated supply chain of the auto industry, every time that product goes across the input to the production goes across the border, it's going to get taxed. Those taxes just build up into prices. It just raises prices, slows economic growth, lowers productivity. generally kind of negative. It's not even zero sum, it's negative sum. Everyone loses. Canada loses. The U.S. loses. Mm-hmm. As far as like, if we can talk about the impacts on the Canadian economy or the housing market, really kind of depends. So this is where like economists get a little wonky with like, what's the impact of tariffs? Well, let me give you 17 different scenarios, because it does, like, if we don't retaliate, then maybe it's a little more clear what the implications are. And by retaliate, I mean just put our own tariffs on imports from the United States into Canada. If we didn't retaliate, which is usually like a lot of economists will like soberly recommend, like, let's not retaliate, because it means, yeah, we'll take the hit to our exports and probably domestic investment and everything else. But the implications for monetary policy are more clear, because you're most likely then to get inflation that's falling below target. And it's pretty obvious what the Bank of Canada is going to do with inflation below target and an economy that is zero growth or contracting, what, you know, based on whatever their current forecast is. That's not the route we're gonna go down. I think even as an economist, like, rightly decided to retaliate. I don't know how you couldn't. And retaliate not just with tariffs on US imports, but in other ways too. Pulling, you know, US liquor off the shelves and all that kind of thing.
Procurement contracts.
Yeah. Exactly. But the implications then for monetary policy and inflation are far less clear. And you saw that in the Bank of Canada's interest rate decision yesterday. They're like really trying to communicate to the public that like, don't expect the Bank of Canada to ride to the rescue this time around. Even if the economy is a lot weaker, their baseline forecast is that inflation is going to be running, because of tariffs, if they're implemented, at like 2.5% for like a 2-year period, if you look at their projections. So with inflation running above target, even with an economy that's pretty weak, kind of handcuffs them a little bit. They're mandated to keep inflation at 2% over the medium term. Pretty hard for them to lower rates. So like, when we run a similar inflation shock in our models, it tells us that the Bank of Canada probably have to leave rates at where they are right now at 2.75, or whatever they think like the midpoint of neutral is. So that's really difficult, right? That means that we have a Canadian economy now that is suffering from lower demand for our exports, and an economy that's contracting, and the Bank of Canada can't lower rates, and that makes everything kind of worse. So that's the situation. That's unfortunately, like, the baseline forecast is like what I call like junior stagflation, where it's like, it's not the 70s with like double digit inflation and an economy that's tanking, but it's like really slow or slightly negative growth and inflation that's higher than the Bank of Canada wants. And that's unfortunately kind of like the baseline. And the implications for housing then are, if you know, people are worried about losing their jobs or are losing their jobs and rates aren't coming down, that's a recipe for sales to be pretty slow.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, as I listen to you walk through the knock-on effects, I know for a lot of people it's a lot putting all those pieces together. Yeah. It seems pretty simple that if you are going to tax a product, you know, the burden of that tariff is going to be borne by different parties to different extents, depending on a bunch of things. And I mean, we can talk about elasticities if we want here or not, but, you know, quite simply, we can look at the example of oil, right? So to the extent that the purchasers of oils, like for refining purposes in the States or whatever, in the short term, they're not going to pivot away from that resource coming from Canada because of a 10% tariff, a 25% tariff, 50% tariff. So that cost is going to, and because the end product, I mean, I think 2/3 of our exports to the US are intermediate goods.
Sure.
So that means they're used in the production of other things. And so, you know, when we look at some of the products for which demand is fairly inelastic, where it's not going to change a whole lot in the short term in response to a change in prices, it seems pretty clear that there's there is an increased cost pass on that is significant there to the purchasers in that country. So in this case, the US. Why doesn't it's not a question to ask you maybe, this is a rhetorical question. Like, why doesn't the administration understand that? Or is there another play here where they're looking longer term and banking on some productivity growth to bring prices down?
So every once in a while, and out of character, I try and in my presentation to be fair to the Trump administration. Yeah, very briefly. And like, can you build like a steel man case for tariffs? And the head of his Council of Economic Advisors, Stephen Miron, wrote this really influential paper for a hedge fund pre-election about like what he sees are the problems with the global trading system, and what are the problems with the United States and how to fix it. And it's, I find parts of it kind of incoherent in, but like you can find an economic philosophy in there. That's essentially when China was added to the WTO and allowed into like the global trading sector, it was a really bad deal for the United States in exchange for like really cheap goods at Walmart, which certainly benefits households, especially low income households. The trade-off was the destruction of the American competitiveness of their manufacturing sector. So their trade deficit with China actually blew out their manufacturing employment. Mm-hmm. Fell for decades as a share of employment, mm-hmm. Fell for decades. And, you know, China's a currency manipulator. They take the dollars that they gain in selling all those cheap goods to the United States and they recycle them back into U.S. treasuries, drives up the U.S. dollar to higher than perhaps it should be, mm-hmm. Keeps the Chinese economy more competitive. And they haven't, like some developing economies try and do, reorient towards domestic demand. They're still just fueling their economy through exports. Really high savings economy. And so Stephen Miron would suggest we need to penalize an economy like that.
Mm-hmm. By so tariffing that, Canada and Mexico.
Exactly. So, like, so yeah. he wanted the 60% tariff on China to try and force them to reorient their economy towards domestic consumption. How that argument applies to Canada, yeah. I have absolutely no idea. Too, so like, I think Trump looks at that argument. It's like, and he sees tariffs. I like tariffs. Tariffs are great. What are the largest importers to the United States? What are the biggest numbers I can put a tariff on? And it's Mexico and Canada and China. It's like, let's do that.
Yeah.
And that's where you end up.
And there's an acknowledgement that they need Canadian oil, even though he says we don't need it, by going 10% on energy as opposed to 25%. There's an acknowledgement of that need. They rely on Canadian heavy crude. All their refineries are oriented towards them.
Yeah.
So regardless of what he says in the media,
so
there is a tacit acknowledgement there.
So like your question, like what's their long-term philosophy though? Seems to be, and you kind of hear it in their arguments now, where like this is we need this transition period where like, yeah, the economy might be weaker, but it's in service of building up an economy that's more sustainable or less reliant on government spending and more like building up the manufacturing sector. And Stephen Miron's argument too is about like maybe the US dollar shouldn't be the reserve currency. So this is where the incoherence comes. Not that everyone's like, oh, tell me more about this Stephen Miron paper. Yeah. But it's like a tariff. If you put a tariff on other countries, your exchange rate appreciates. Yeah. So it actually makes you less competitive. It actually doesn't do so if you were looking to reduce your trade deficit, tariffs don't work very well because they tend to increase the value of your currency. So anyway.
It's hard to know what they really think and understand because they also seem to take major issue with any sort of bilateral trade deficit in any sort of trading relationship they have, whether that's Canada, China. They think they're being ripped off. So there's a sense that maybe Trump and his team doesn't understand the economics of trade.
I don't, but like this is the thing that drives me the most mad is, and mad isn't crazy, not mad isn't angry, what do they actually believe? Because they lie like crazy. So yes. Even the evidence they provide for why they need a tariff, and it's entirely like, I don't understand all of this, and I'm not going to bore the audience with my limited understanding of it, but the president doesn't actually have authority to implement tariffs unless it's an economic mm-hmm. emergency. Otherwise, you have to go through Congress. There's all these different section whatever types of tariffs. So they've made up this fentanyl excuse that is obviously a lie because we have data about how much fentanyl has been seized at the border and every Canadian can recite that it's 43 pounds.
Yeah, also that. It fits in a backpack.
Yeah. But you know, half of that too is not even seized at the border.
The Globe and Mail did a great piece about how a lot of it's from like 100 miles south of the border and has come from Mexico, but is close enough to the Canadian border.
That they call it northern border.
They just allocated.
Someone clicks a box.
So some of it got seized in Spokane, Washington,
so
for example.
When you see someone like Peter Navarro, who's an idiot, or Kevin Hassett, who's an idiot, go on TV and say the Canadian landscape is littered with fentanyl labs and the RCMP is ignoring it, mm-hmm. they're just lying. Yeah. So it's really hard to tell when they're lying and when they actually believe something. I don't know what Trump believes. I don't know what Scott Bessin believes. Everyone thought he was an adult. And then he goes on TV and says absolute nonsense things all the time. Yeah. So it's really hard to tell what do they want. Mm. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like a fool sometimes trying to understand or work through what the thinking might be from an economics point of view, because if I step back for a moment, I don't believe that they're actually having these conversations or these thoughts. I mean, I see the tariffs as an instrument to, you know, lever out concessions from other countries. It's the strategy from that administration is, you know, shoot for 100. If you end up getting 30, that's a win. And there is an acknowledgement by the administration, as you said, Rye, that trade does matter, that it does bring benefits. We see that by virtue of the differential tariff rates. We also see it from the Secretary of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins, who, you know, egg prices have been increasing.
She's the one that was like, yeah. She's the one like, just start raising your own chickens.
Raise your own chickens.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Or import Canadian eggs.
Just become a subsistence farmer.
Yeah, it's fine. Exactly. That's
everyone's dream, right?
Make America great again. So, But you touched on it, right, which is she said that the administration was going to look at some temporary cheap import options. And it was like, oh, light bulb moment. Trade matters. Trade brings benefits.
We'll import them, but we will also tariff them on their way in.
That's right. That's right. We look at BC here. Like we know, I mean, this is like when, you know, before COVID, nobody knew what the inflation rate was. No one knew what the Bank of Canada's overnight rate was. COVID hit. Now everybody knows. And also everyone knows when the data comes out. It's like a new world, right? And I'm feeling that here as well, where we all know that 3/4 of Canadian goods exports go to the United States. When we look across the country, that share of provincial exports that go south of the border varies considerably, quite dependent on the types of products that are being sent down there. You know, Alberta, which is, you know, obviously it's largely oil, it's energy exports that are going across the border. I think 90% rise the number of their exports go to the US, goods exports. In BC, it's 53%. Mm-hmm. So I look at that and I go, does that mean that the province is maybe a little bit more insulated? Not every sector in every region, but broadly speaking, is BC a little more insulated from this tariff kerfuffle than other provinces, like say Ontario?
Yeah, it's if you look at like the sectors too, like it's, you know, 22% is like oil and gas, and 4% is electricity. So like there's a big chunk of that 54% that's like, again, not very elastic probably, but like we've seen the impact tariffs can have. Like forestry sector got decimated in 2018. Yep. And now there's a 25% on aluminum. Like what's that going to do to the Kitimat smelter and like the jobs that are there and like, you know, support that community. And then think about any of the manufacturers and everything else on the Northwest coast, or like interior, forestry, it's going to have a real impact. So we have less exposure, but like, It's like the Chamber of Commerce put a map out on like where the hotspots were. It was pretty interesting. None of them were in BC, like, and they're all like, they were major cities, right? And so none of the major cities have that much vulnerability because most of our direct exposure is like in rural communities. So like Trevor Toome has a great map with like a heat map of where the impacts are. And they're like the Northeast, the Northwest coast and the interior. That doesn't mean we have no exposure, right? Like there's still knock-on effects. And then, you know, we're also, you know, what, 15 to 20% of our exports go to China, and they're also feeling effects of a trade war. And so their demand might slow and global trade might slow. And so that's going to have an effect on BC exports in general. But like when we did, like when we kind of estimated the impacts, like we came up with like growth is either going to be, we've done it a couple of times. So our original estimate was between like a negative 0.7 and a negative 1 or something impact on GDP growth or on GDP.
As a percentage point.
And revise that. I think now we're at like somewhere between 0 and like negative 0.5 with an unemployment rate rising to like 6.7% or something in the next 2 years. Pretty similar to what the Ministry of Finance put out in their budget. Really similar estimate. So that's like really slow growth where like, so maybe the Canadian economy is slightly contracting and the BC economy is just like not growing. Neither are great, but it's, you know, we have less exposure. It's like, would you rather have like a broken wrist or a broken leg? It's like, well, neither really, but you know, yeah. Those are the choices.
It's interesting in BC's largest metros, at least what we've seen looking at historical data is during periods of economic difficulty, so recession or otherwise, just where we have sort of slower growth, there is this like retrenchment. There's a domestic flows, like for Metro Vancouver as an example, which typically domestic flows of migrants, they tend to be on a net basis negative, driven by movement within the province, where we have fewer people moving to Metro Vancouver from other parts of BC than move to other parts of the province from this region. When things are slow, we see people sort of come back for a whole bunch of reasons. I think one of them is just like larger labor markets.
Yeah.
There's more dynamism in a larger job market, more turnover. There's a perception of perhaps more opportunity.
Yeah, just to add, like, go back 25 years and the two times that Metro Vancouver's had positive net domestic migration is 2015 and 2009. So 2015 was a recession almost entirely in Alberta, so a huge flow of people. And then obviously we know what happened in 2008, 2009.
Yeah. So it's interesting to consider that. I mean, there's a lot of things, a lot of interplay here, tough to sort of predict how it's going to play out.
But even like you look at those maps, but then you look at maybe this is a good transition to talk about the housing market.
Great.
But if you look at what areas are getting really beaten up in February, it's like the Lower Mainland.
Yeah.
Fraser Valley was in rough shape. Chilliwack's in rough shape. Vancouver, the Greater Vancouver Realtor area. So like Metro Vancouver is really getting beat up. It's hard to point to anything besides like uncertainty. And everyone is now seeing the Stanford Uncertainty Index, whatever, the Economic Policy Uncertainty Index. I think it used to be at Stanford. Economist. I don't know if it's out of Stanford. Anyway, not a super important detail.
You sound like my mother right now, John. It was at 5 o'clock when Mary called. No, it was 5:05. I think
me and your mother have a lot in common. that uncertainty is really weighing on. Like you guys saw the same data I did. Like sales really fell off. I was really bullish on 2025 heading into the year, and sales completely fell off in February, and more so in the Lower Mainland and like in the interior or something where the impacts are going to be the worst.
Yeah. Victoria was surprisingly doing much better.
Yeah. Victoria was like really strong before, like they were running it. I think it was like 10 or 15% above average. And that came down to like average.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then we just checked quickly and like Calgary, Edmonton, Toronto, Montreal, all same thing. Like clearly uncertainty is weighing on everyone. People are afraid to make large purchases.
And you saw it in the, you saw it in the Bank of Canada's survey data they released yesterday, like the sectors where people are worried about their employment over the next year. And it's like, oil, gas and manufacturing and forestry. Mm-hmm. And like that uncertainty is having a major impact already. Like even without tariffs totally in place, they're already impacting. Like their sales right now are basically where like our model showed they would be in the first quarter with tariffs in place. So
that means. Survey, a quarter of Canadians said they're delaying major purchase decisions and saving more for rainy day.
And then even getting back to like what really matters is what happens with inflation, at least for the potential recovery. And you see households and business expectations for inflation.
That's scary.
Prices increase in the next year. You've got 50% of businesses expected to raise prices in the next year with tariffs. So.
Yeah, we put out a, you said you were bullish on housing for 2025. And I think we saw it as a sort of return to average. Mm-hmm. We thought better than 2024, better than 2023 in terms of overall activity, just a bit more fluidity in the market.
Which I think we had a 25% increase in sales counts, which is substantial.
Dramatic, but it was still not even up to...
That's just getting to the 10-year average.
So we put out our forecasts for 2025 at the end of January, basically at the same time that Trump was announcing that across the board tariffs were going to apply here.
Same thing.
It felt really good. Yeah. It was a good use of time leading up to that. So we haven't yet, we haven't gone back and revised all of those forecasts, but
it's hard to do, right?
It is hard
but
to do.
But if we do, then they'll change again.
I know.
Well, so you question the value.
This could be how we get tariffs removed.
Right. I guess the question is though, to me, we talk about uncertainty and yes, the actual tariff schedule matters. What products does it apply to? How much is the tariff? To me, if there's no line drawn under anything, I mean, it feels like we could be under this cloud for I mean, the foreseeable future. I'm not sure what the end game is. I don't think anyone knows what that is, what that looks like.
No.
So, I mean, I'm curious. I don't know if you've updated a sales forecast for this year, but how do you see the markets in BC and more specifically in the Lower Mainland and in Victoria playing out?
It's so hard, like with this kind of uncertainty. I mean, I feel like it's harder to forecast now almost than it was during COVID, because like then you're like, yeah, it's gonna be really bad. Yeah. Maybe it'll get better. Yeah. But at least the monetary policy implications were clear too.
Right.
Yeah. This time around, it's so unclear. You know, the way our recoveries normally happen when we have a downturn is that rates fall and sales start to usually lead the recovery. Mm-hmm. If rates aren't going to come down, we can't say whether or not they are, then it just gets very difficult to say. And it's even, you know, when I'm part of the Minister of Finance's Forecast Council, and they gave us like, hey, do you guys want to like, and we met in late January, right as the tariffs were being announced. And they were like, do you guys want to revise your forecast? You have till Tuesday, like February 4th. It's like, and then so that day I was like, it's like, oh my God. Like, cause that was the day the tariffs came into effect, I think. And we're like, I was emailing with Brian Yu and just mentioned him way too often on this podcast. It's like, are you going to revise your, he's like, I don't know if it's worth it. He's like, I think I'm going to revise it. And then like that afternoon it's like, oh, it's a 30 day delay. We're like, whatever, I'm not doing this. Yeah. Just keep it in where it was. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so with housing too, like I don't want to put out a forecast that's like, this is going to get really bad without see in a few months, at least, of it being like, oh, like people, I think, always overstate the influence that people like us have. Like, why are you saying that the market's going to be bad? You're driving it down. It's like, I don't have that kind of power.
No.
But it's, you know, it's like, it's still in your head, I think, that like, oh, like if I'm like really wrong and things. So like, it's hard to put out a forecast at this point. That's not just like, here's a bunch of scenarios. I don't know which one of these it's going to be.
Yeah. I mean,
which is always more valuable than point forecasts anyway.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So,
yeah, I mean, if you get away from the forecasting and the economics of it, the way I look at the market, right, like all the time, but especially right now, is sort of like, what are the things that might spur demand? And if that's too sort of abstract, what are the factors that might spur an individual who wasn't going to buy a home to now participate, to actively look to get qualified for a mortgage with a mortgage broker and be ready to actually make that investment.
And I think like well thought out scenarios are really valuable. Like there's some like not to throw shade at the CMHC, but they'll put out a forecast. They're just like, and here's a confidence interval. And it's like, things are going to be terrible or pretty great. Yeah. It's like, that's not that useful.
Yeah.
Right. But if you put out scenarios that are like, here, if we have these sorts of things play out, then we can expect this. And I think that's really useful, especially for realtors, be like, oh, okay. Like then I can tell, at least I have a narrative about what I should look for, you know, this type of market or that. That's like it's harder to put all of that in a table. Where it's like, here's my forecast. Yeah. Right. But I think that's far more valuable in this type of scenario than just like put it out. Like sales are going to be up 22.1%.
Why? Don't know.
Sure. Let's move
on. Feels like it should be.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Cassidy Bast, Director of Advisor Growth and Career Development of Rennie. Do you like what you're hearing? Are you ready to grow your real estate career? At Rennie, we invest in people. With a trusted brand, powerful market intel, and a full-service brokerage, we provide the tools and insights you need to expand and thrive in your business. Visit joinus.rennie.com and let's talk about how Rennie can elevate your business.
There's also another sort of source of uncertainty, but I'm not sure that it's impacting in any material way at all the economy, the housing market. But we will have a new government in some form. We'll have a new prime minister
tomorrow.
Yes. And then we'll find out whether that person, Mark Carney, is in for the next 5 years, or we have Pierre Poilievre. Is there anything, I mean, the race is a lot closer than it was a couple months ago, which is just incredible. Obviously, it's what's happening south of the border. It's the change in leadership within the Liberal Party. I guess you can give us your prediction. How do you see that playing out? And then the follow-up is really, you know, is there anything regardless of party, like whoever the party is, I mean, is there any kind of a material impact that they're going to have on regional housing markets?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, there aren't a lot of like policy platforms yet, so it's really hard to say anything. Mm-hmm. And like, obviously the conservatives' major issues have been kind of taken away. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what, I mean, if you kind of put all of your eggs in one basket on like, this is the biggest problem in the economy, and then your opponent's like, cool, let's get rid of it. And they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Congratulations. My work here is done. I don't know.
In case anyone wasn't sure, he's talking about the carbon tax.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
I think everyone knows, but just in case.
You spoke its name. We had a carbon tax in BC since like 2007 that no one complained about for 15 years, but okay.
Worse.
Anyway. Yeah, so I have no idea. Like, I don't know what their policies are. Obviously, Polyev is sort of, I think he's talked about housing and about gatekeepers or whatever. Anyway, I think it's mostly about like, you know, cutting red tape and all that's great. We need to do more of that. I don't know what it's so limited what the federal government can do on housing that it sort of doesn't really matter a lot. Like, it'd be cool if they tried to do more and like they provide, you know, a lot of it's like, how much money can we provide you? And do we do that with carrots or sticks? Mm-hmm. Seems to be like all that it comes down to. But like the more important issues are at the provincial and mostly municipal level at this point. So like, I don't know, unless they can force municipalities to like do permitting faster and adopt zoning that makes sense, then like, and they don't, I don't know enough about it. Obviously there's a limited amount the federal government can do. With housing, it's much more at the municipal level, somewhat at the provincial level. All they can really do is provide funding and some, you know, form of incentive, carrot, stick, whatever, penalty for doing this, prizes for doing that, whatever. It's such a, you know, municipal issue that you can understand why they talk about it, because like, when, you know, no one's happy with the state of housing really across North America. And when housing is a struggle, your entire life is a struggle. Yeah. There's no surprise that people, especially young people, are really angry. And if you're a political party and you're not talking about housing, then you're going to make a lot of potential voters really angry. But most of those voters probably don't totally understand that the federal government doesn't have a lot to do with housing. And they should really be pointing that anger at municipal government. But I don't know what the share of like the population that votes in municipal elections is, it's probably pretty low, and who's following, you know, who's going to council meetings and whatnot. So
who has the time
right?
to go to third readings and public hearings and
that last like 4 hours. Like, what time did this start? What time is it now? Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on to our recurring segment we call Beneath the Headline, where we usually cherry pick a headline about local housing related topics that maybe could use a little more context. But since we're talking so much about the idiocy or idiocracy of the current trade war,
I need to see that movie.
Trade
I haven't
kerfuffle.
Seen it.
You haven't?
Oh, it's no. A great movie.
I know. And now it's just going to be depressing at how accurate it is.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So we picked one from the States, and so I've taken one that's just really summarizing a recent poll. So many Americans see Trump's actions on economy as too erratic, and honestly, it's a little disheartening. It's only 57% of Americans think he's being too erratic, and shockingly, I've got a 44% approval rating on
which is low for the time in like the state, like, or the like how the long he's been in the presidency,
but considering
how far into this term he is,
considering how quickly he has absolutely tanked financial markets, you think more people might be upset with the Dow Jones.
Use
that one.
Oh boy.
And it's interesting though that when they're asked about it, they're like, yeah, it's like, this is a transition.
Stock market doesn't matter anymore.
Normally they were obsessed with the stock market as like a scorecard. I think what they need to do more and more is like juxtapose the US stock market with like Germany is up like 20% or something. Like, wow, the Germans are killing us.
And the Hang Seng in China.
Sure.
But remember too, I mean, there's this theory out there that they are creating the chaos to
get somewhere.
Funnel investors over to safer
this
assets.
But it's like the underpants gnomes from South Park. You ever see that episode? All right. So episode of South Park where you have these gnomes that come in at night, steal your underwear, mm-hmm. and their business model is steal underpants, question mark equals profit. There's like, and this is like tank the market, wreck the economy. Question mark.
Well, I think the idea is that as investors move into like safer assets, like longer term treasuries, mm-hmm. that they drive down
interest rates.
And I can't remember the exact numbers, like how much of a decline in that longer term yield would generate savings of a particular magnitude. I saw $100 billion a year in interest costs being saved. If it's something like, I don't know, like a percentage point, if the long-term treasury yields went down by a percentage point.
How much debt matures this year?
I just think there's too many layers. I think if you have to go through a couple of layers of logic or connecting the dots, then I don't think that that's part of the plan.
It's weird that for people that only ever demonize government, that they're suddenly, they've shifted to this like idea of like being a rich country is having a lot of government revenue.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where we hear Trump talk about we were never richer than when we had tariffs. And it's like, well, what are you talking about? Obviously wealth is way higher. GDP per capita is way higher. Like, I don't know what this measure is. And it seems like they're talking about government revenue and like their budget, like whether the budget's close to being balanced or something. Mm-hmm. And like, that's not a gauge of like a country's wealth I've ever heard of, but it seems to. And again, they hate the government, so I don't know why they want to give it more money. It makes absolutely no sense. I don't understand it.
Well, it could be an office space play by by Trump and his cronies, right? Yeah. So the more money that's coming in, the more their own coffers can fill up. No one will notice.
Maybe that's a fraction of a cent. Yeah. The Superman 3, the Superman 3 plan.
To close things off, we do have a question from one of our listeners.
Ooh. What's up, Ryan's? Mikey here from Coquitlam. I'm a first-time buyer, and I feel like I've been waiting forever to get into the market. I'm kind of just sitting on my money. Are there any real signs that affordability is actually going to improve this year or like soon? Or is it just as tough as last year? Big fan of the pod. Thanks.
Thank you for the question. So he said he's a first-time home buyer waiting to get into the market. Are there any real signs that affordability is improving in this market, or are things really just as tough as they were a year ago?
I mean, affordability has objectively improved over the last year. Not to say that it is affordable or as affordable as it was 5 years ago. Yeah. But if you look over the last 12 months, variable rates have come down by 225 basis points, material change. Fixed rates have on average come down about 90 basis points, and values haven't risen. In fact, they've declined marginally. So at the region level, the composite benchmark price is down a little under 2%. And for a first-time buyer, that condo benchmark value is down about 3%. So lower borrowing costs and similar to slightly lower home values means that affordability has improved at the margin.
Yeah, and like when we run long-term simulations, we have like a policy analysis model that we built. And like the trend is sort of like over the next 10 years, affordability gets, I mean, it got a lot worse during the pandemic. So it went up vertically for whatever your measure is. In our model, it went up from about, I don't know, 35-40% mortgage payment to income. It'll change depending on the type of, you know, what rate you use, what income you use, whatever, to like 60% of income. And then it has come down to, I don't know, low 50s with prices and rates. The real important thing is like, where does it go from here? Mm-hmm. And what we need to have happen is for incomes to outpace price growth. Like say rates stabilize, whatever, between 4 and 4.5% on a 5-year fixed rate. We need home prices to grow basically with inflation. Over the last 40 years in the province, they've grown like a 6% annual rate. If they keep doing that, they double every 10 years. We don't want that to happen. Compound interest really works against us in this sense. So what can we do to ensure that price growth is much slower over the next decade? Our models have it at 4% because we're building a lot more than we used to. Like, I remember when I started in this job, a good year for housing starts was like 30,000 to 35,000. And now it's like
for the province.
And now it's like 40,000 to 45,000 for the province.
Yeah.
So that we're building a lot more, and that in our estimates is enough to bring long run average home price growth down to like 4%. Mm-hmm. But then incomes are only probably going to grow at like 3.5%. And so, but you know, affordability gets steadily worse. How do we actually get it to, how do we bend that curve back down to where we were pre-pandemic? And it's really hard to do without a lot more supply and slowing the rate of price growth. It doesn't mean prices have to fall. Mm-hmm. They just have to grow slower.
That's right. Yeah.
And you know, we've had periods like that post-financial crisis in the Fraser Valley or in the Okanagan. Prices were flat for like 8 years.
For years.
Because we had a lot of supply. And even the Fraser Valley now, like supply is getting a little high.
Yeah.
So we could have pretty flat prices there as well. The real big problem in the housing market, especially in Vancouver, is like an inability to match demand and supply in a timely fashion.
Yeah.
So we get periods where supply gets really low and supply of listings, and we have a demand shock that inevitably happen, totally out of our control, and prices rapidly accelerate. So like we need a consistent supply of listings that we can absorb those types of demand shocks. And that's like, that's the real problem with the housing market is that it's really hard to match. You know, supply takes forever, demand's overnight, and like it's really, we need to compress the timeline, the timing on supply so that it can better offset those demand shocks. And that's just really hard to do.
It is hard to do. I mean, there have been in BC recently, there's a pilot program was launched by the BC Financial Services Authority, which gives developers who are bringing towers to the market extra time to actually market and sell those towers and get to the point where they sell enough so that they can get their financing from their bank to actually start construction. So I think when we look at projects these days being a lot bigger than they used to be, about 60% bigger than they were a decade ago. And we look at multifamily towers that are just coming to the market.
The time to complete has been like expanding and expanding and expanding.
The time to complete, it takes longer and longer.
It also takes longer to get your permits too.
Yeah.
Well, it's longer to get your permits. It's longer to sell. And then it's longer to build. And so that timeline has been stretched out. So this pilot program has been launched and hopefully it becomes, you know, more permanent than just a pilot. I think that's a move in the right direction, but that's the source of most of our housing supply in a market like Metro Vancouver. It is that multifamily segment. And
that's like a 7 year cycle. Like can you imagine anything else? If you're like building a shed and you're like, hey, you're almost done that shed. It's like, yeah, I got a few more years to go.
Well, maybe we'll
maybe by the time the kids are out of high school, we might have it done.
Radical thought. Why don't we build more like Paris and Barcelona? And we can look at, I mean, a lot of people won't like this. I mean, and listen, the provincial government has opened the door to it. I don't think there's a lot of takers right now, but we look at the, you know, 65%, I think, of the residential land in the city of Vancouver is zoned single family, something like that. If we built in to a lower density, but over a larger geographic area, instead of concentrating intense density in these small nodes, we may see a more, maybe we would see a steadier supply of new homes in all market conditions too. Because the problem right now is the demand isn't there to soak up all of the homes that are available. Inventory is at an all-time high in the new home.
Did you read, segment. I think it was Paul Beaudry wrote a paper for the City How about like, we just need more cities.
Yeah,
I'm
more talking with cities, him in a couple weeks to talk through that paper. I'm fascinated by
fascinating it. And like, you could argue in BC, we're kind of doing like Richmond's going to be kind of a like big city. Surrey is going to be bigger than the city of Vancouver. Like we're building more cities and they are in Burnaby, like they're getting denser and denser and denser. So it's not like we have to only do it in the city of Vancouver, but like, can we also do that in Penticton?
Well, that's where it really matters.
That's where it's outside of the metro area. Like, can we build up? Like, can we even build up Chilliwack like that? It seems unlikely.
It seems unlikely. Yeah. I mean, the jobs have to be there at some point.
Yeah.
The
jobs. And Penticton is like almost as land constrained as anywhere else.
Exactly, right? Well, even like some of the rules, like I think it was in Vernon, and like even some of like the cookie cutter kind of zoning stuff, like you don't have to have parking. And it's like, well, they're trying to build this building in Vernon. It's like, they don't have a parking. It's like, well, like you can't go anywhere. It's Vernon. Yeah. Like, it takes like 45 minutes to get to Kelowna, and like there's not really like transit's going
to
get.
Well, that's
you
where
there.
You need
like,
to
you
match.
You kind of need a car.
You need to really invest in regional transportation infrastructure.
Yeah.
Public transit to make it all work, so you don't have to build in one place.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a really cool idea, and like it makes a lot of sense. But like once you start like overlaying that onto a map of Canada, it's like, well, like where. where are these cities? Are there any jobs there? Does anyone want to live there? Yeah. It's real cold in some of these places.
Yeah.
Like there's a reason why we tend to, you know, congregate in the areas we have because it's really nice.
Yeah. Awesome. Before we wrap up, if people, I mean, we talked about this at the beginning here. You're a lot of what you produce, everything you produce is essentially publicly available. Yep. So how can people access the work that you, the awesome work that you do all the time?
Our website, bcraa.bc.ca. There's an economics tab. You can go there. All of our stuff is online. You can put in your email and have it sent to your inbox if you want. I'm not really on any social media besides LinkedIn, but if you venture over to LinkedIn, I don't think I've ever denied a request. So please don't try to sell me anything. That's really the only place I ever post, although it's, I don't know if you've noticed, like it's becoming a little too like Facebook. Not as bad since like Canada's like reunifying. It hasn't been as bad, but for a while, it was rough. So, I post some stuff there pretty regularly. Yeah, that's if you're a brokerage or something like that, and you want me to come talk to you, you can send me an email or whatever. Yeah.
You really want to do that?
Not really. 50 presentations in 6 months. Probably too much. But I do really enjoy it. Like it's a really fun part of the job. Like maybe not as much as I'm doing it right now, but it's pretty fun to go out and talk to realtors and mortgage brokers in the construction industry and see what they have to say and try and make them laugh every once in a while with outdated cultural references.
Well, I can attest as well to your effectiveness as a speaker. Very entertaining to listen to, always very informative presentations. So take them up on the offer.
I should say, we have actually a wealth of talent in the economics, like the real estate sector in BC. We got you guys do an incredible job. I'm going to get him to mention Brian May for a third time.
It feels like he was haunted today.
Andrew Lissett, Vancouver Realtors. Yeah. And then I feel like Jens von Bergman and all of our friends at CMHC. It's so well covered. Wendy Waters is amazing. Yeah, amazing. Like we have all these amazing people talking about housing. So we're kind of
also lucky. Brian New.
Brian New is also doing.
Well, awesome. Thanks for joining us today. Great conversation.
Yeah. Thanks for the invite.
Thank you for tuning into the Rennie Podcast, where we share our passion for homes, housing, community, and cities. We hope that today's episode sparked the same curiosity in you that drives us every day. If you enjoyed the conversation, don't forget to subscribe and follow us on your favorite podcast platform. And if you have a moment, we'd love for you to leave a review. It helps others discover the insights, analysis, and perspective we bring from the Rennie Intelligence Division. For the latest market updates, be sure to register at rennie.com.
Thank you for joining us on the Rennie Podcast. If you'd like to learn more, all resources mentioned in the episode can be found at rennie.com/intelligence. To be the first to receive this information, register for intelligence updates.